This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This week on Cadenza, we'll visit with a fascinating artist who we hope you heard last Friday evening on our broadcast of music from the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. One of the most multifaceted that I've had a privilege to interview, the composer, clarinetist, improviser, and teacher, Evan Zaporin. Mr. Zaporin was born in Chicago and studied music composition at Eastman, Yale, and UC Berkeley. He performed and composed in many different styles and genres of music, from contemporary classical to jazz, but his encounter with the music of Bali, in a setting he'll relate, changed his life, his creative course, and led him to embrace, study, and master this music that has so fascinated Western composers going back to Debussy upon hearing its unique and intoxicating tone color and rhythms. My guest took two trips to Bali and then decided to form his own gamelan orchestra here in the U.S. at the place where he teaches, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT in Boston, where he is still director of MIT's Technology Center for Art, Science, and Technology, as well as distinguished professor of music. He founded his group, Gamelan Galaktika, nearly 25 years ago. It's made up of MIT students, faculty, alums, and folks from the community. But his gamelan strand is only one that makes up his career in life. He performed at the first Bang on a Can Marathon in New York City back in 1987, and by 1992 had co-founded Bang on a Can All-Stars, taking their boundary-pushing music to all points of the globe. He spent 25 years with that organization, and now, in addition to his teaching and gamelan, is part of an improvising trio with the Czech violinist and vocalist Eva Batova and guitarist Gian Riley. And he's still composing music for himself to play on clarinet, mostly bass clarinet, as well as works for larger forces. You're listening to the closing minutes of his work called Big Grenadilla, a nickname for his bass clarinet. He is the soloist accompanied by the Boston Modern Orchestra Project led by Gil Rose, who was my Cadenza guest 2 weeks back. I spoke with Evan Zaporin on the stage at Wolfenson Hall at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton between his concerts presented with Gamelan Galaktika a few weeks ago. I'm here on the stage of Wolfenson Hall, like we have been so often, with composer, what do you put behind it, clarinetist, teacher, whatever, Evan Zipporin. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you, too.
You're fascinating because of all the different, I'm going to use the word, fabrics that make up your life, and we're going to touch on those. And I'm going to start with one which says that you and I have two common grounds. One is that we're both Chicago guys. I'm born in Oak Park on the west side, home of Bob Newhart and Ernest Hemingway. You're born in the suburb just on the north border of Chicago, which houses the university I did my graduate study at, which is home of Northwestern, which is Evanston. Second common ground is when I was doing my graduate degrees, I worked at a record store down in downtown Chicago, one of the legendary stores, Rose Records, right underneath the Wabash L, and I worked there. You, while doing studies at Yale, worked at a used record store in New Haven, and you had an epiphany. So you heard this recording on the wonderful old Nonesuch Explorer series. It basically changed your life, but you heard something you'd never heard. Now, most people back then, before the internet, would have heard something like that and said, oh, what is this, and researched it and gone to the library, encyclopedias, blah, blah, blah. You took it the next step. So I want you to tell our audience what you, the actions you did take and what that led to. You could pick up the story from there.
Sure, although I'm tempted to just talk about working in record stores. So the record, as you mentioned, was from Music from the Morning of the World, a fantastic David Lewiston recorded selection of things from Bali. And, you know, you said I heard something I'd never heard before, and that's true, but in a very subjective way, because I had actually heard Balinese gamelan before. I just didn't pay any attention to it. It wasn't the right time. And somehow, you know, I was restocking bins or something, and this music came on, and I heard it in a different way because I wasn't expecting it and I wasn't looking for it. And it just blew my mind. It was just actually what turns out to be a pretty simple Balinese piece called Baris. And it was doing everything I wanted music to do, and it was doing everything that I was hearing in The Rite of Spring and in Bartok's Fifth String Quartet and in, you know, Miles Davis' Bitches Brew and, you know, Coltrane and anything else I could get my hands on that was using rhythm in a kind of what seemed like a new way, in a really propulsive way, but making large forms, kind of strange sonorities that were really passionate yet kind of cool. Really virtuosic, but graceful. And I just thought, where have you been all my life? So then some coincidences happened, because I was just at a pizza place in New Haven, and I was about to start studying composition with Martin Bresnik, who was also David Lang's teacher and, you know, has been a good friend for a long time. I didn't really know him then, but I was in a booth at what was then Naples Pizza. Those were these kind of, you have a bunch of them around here too, you know, with these kind of wood booths that people carve into the tables. So I was just sitting there, and I overheard Martin Bresnik, who I barely knew, say, oh, my student Michael Tenzer just got back from Bali and brought a whole gamelan with him. So I literally leaned over, kind of sat up in the booth, leaned over and said, can you give me that guy's phone number? And I expected him to be around and I could go see him and maybe find out something. But the phone number was a California phone number. And he was out in Berkeley. He had just started a group. And I called him up out of the blue. And again, pre-internet, that's what you did.
Right.
You call people up. And I said, well, I heard this gamelan, I'm really interested. And he said, well, why don't you come out this summer and just join the group? So I did that. And then I was hooked. Then I went to Bali and spent quite a lot of time in the 1980s there studying. And yeah. I guess it changed my life.
So, because some of our listeners still, most of them, many of them have heard gamelan, Bali, those words Java put together, but sort of take us through what it is, as you discovered what it is, what the meaning of the word, which actually is very synonymous with our word percussion, but the meaning of the word, how you found out what it was, what it meant in the Balinese society, musically what it's made up of, because you had to discover all this too as you figured out about it, so...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's cyclical music. It's percussion-based. It's mainly metallophones, basically little xylophones. Mm-hmm. It's tuned in a non-tempered pentatonic scale. And the music is really brilliantly... There's all sorts of different gamelans in Java and Bali, but Balinese gongkibyar, which is the kind I was interested in first, and Balinese music in general, is generally fast. It's generally loud. It's cyclically based, but the cycles are long. And it still is concerned with these long structures, right? So, you know, you can have a piece in Balinese music, it's all going to be cycles, but the cycles, some of them are going to be 4 beats long, some of them are going to be like 12 beats long, some of them will be irregular length, some of them, in some of the older pieces, will be 256 beats long. Mm-hmm. And then within these cycles, things happen. So the cycles themselves are kind of, you know, have a narrative to them. They get faster, they get slower, they're interrupted with these kind of amazing rhythms. And then they all lead back to where they came from. And then they're connected by through composed sections, which often have very, very strange rhythms called kibyar that are really unnotatable, you know, in a way that's accurate. Right. But they're synchronized, non-metric.
Because the music there is not notated. They're not reading off of music.
Right.
It is learned and passed down, even? And how are new pieces learned are just learned by... Well.
No, it's learned, as you can see, we're sitting on the stage, and the students are here, like, the players sit on one side, the teacher just sits on the other and just plays backwards. And you just learn it phrase by phrase, pattern by pattern, cycle by cycle, until you have a whole piece. And so, I mean, obviously they have older traditional pieces, which people are hearing all the time, because you mentioned the connection to culture. It's very embedded in traditional Balinese culture. Now, of course, that's changing now, as it is everywhere, but when I was there, still the main lifestyle was agricultural, rice farming. People lived in villages, and they would get together in the village kind of meeting houses and rehearse. And, you know, when they had temple anniversaries, because they have this very devout form of Hinduism that they do there, they have to make offerings, and the offerings are food, cleaning, and then also music and dance, right? So they all have to know something about the music because they're all doing it. But, you know, there are still professional musicians or, you know, highly adept amateur musicians. It's not like everybody is brilliant,
right.
but everybody knows the traditional repertoire. I remember once years ago kind of driving from Boston to New York with a great Balinese puppeteer, Wayan Ouija, and I was just playing him random Balinese cassettes that I had had from over the years. He knew every tune. He was singing along with everything. And you couldn't stump him, you know.
I mean, it's kind of analogous to our folk song base. Or
yeah, I
think
so. Would
know the song and sing along even if they hadn't sung it since they were a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
The final work given on the concert at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton a few weeks ago, a concert given by my guest Evan Zaporin and his gamelan Galik Tika, was a work by him called Aradhana, which finds its root word with many meanings in Javanese, including to draw or to bow, and in fact this work is for gamelan using cello bows to create sound, plus guest artist Sumi Koneko on the Japanese koto. Here are the opening moments.
I mean, we should say, I said we're sitting on Wolfenson stage, which I do with these interviews, but we are sitting at the very, very front edge because this is a drawback of radio. I'm sorry, listeners. But the entire stage is filled with this gamelan orchestra of, as Evan said, these things that look like xylophones in a way, of various shapes and sizes and lengths, and there's gongs at the back, and it's a fantastic sight. So before we get to the East Coast. So you went back in 87 on a Fulbright and all that stuff. As a Western composer, your mind had to be thinking, how can I bring it? What were your, before you do what you do at where you teach, and we're going to get to that because that's the second part of you, what was your mind spinning as you figured out what was happening, you learned it? I mean, what were you thinking of?
Well, I didn't know what I was getting into. I mean, I was very naive. I had really not traveled that much. I had been to England a couple times, and I really hadn't been out of this country. And I kind of thought, like, oh, learning Balinese music would be like learning about Bartok or learning about Janáček or learning about, you know, something finite, right? Mm. And obviously I had kind of a wanderlust. I wanted to be someplace different. I wanted to experience life in a different way. But the first thing was that the kind of embeddedness of the music in the culture was really stunning to me. And I really felt that there was a relationship between the way the music was constructed, both formally and how it was constructed socially, like how the group worked together, how the pieces worked. I mentioned already that the pieces have these long cycles, and they're really connected to the way the Balinese think about life. So mm-hmm. there's the cycle of rice farming, and there's the cycle of religious ceremonies, and there's the cycles of life, and all these things are marked in these very conscious ways by rituals that come at important points. So there's full time, and then there's empty time. And you hear that in the music. The music goes kind of along in a steady state for a while, and then suddenly something dramatic happens, and then it goes back. And it's also constructed so that some of the parts require incredible virtuosity to play, and some of the parts you can pretty much drag somebody off the street, hand them a gong pong, and go count to four and hit, you know. And that's been great with our group because it's a chance for really professional musicians to play with people who love music but haven't had the chance to really play.
Right.
So there's that part of it, but also the connection to the people, you know, the fact that the music is important to them, it's meaningful, they need it, they know it, they value it. Those were the big lessons, first of all, for me as a university-trained composer in the late 70s and early 80s, where the idea that people would care about your music or that how you worked with a group, how you taught a piece, how you learned a piece, how a group played together had a bearing.
Yeah.
Those were very important lessons to me because that was completely different from the, dare I say, Milton Babbitt kind of approach that was still mainstream in the university system at that
sure.
time, where, okay, the composer is this kind of godlike figure who notates everything, puts it down on the page, and then you hand it off to these slave automaton performers and
who attempt to do it
and never, you know, get it right. And this and play it for an audience that for one reason or another doesn't really want to be there.
Here are the closing moments from my guest Evan Zaporin's work, Aradhana, as recorded at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton a few weeks back. He performs with his gamelan Galiktika and special guest Sumi Koneko on Japanese koto, and hears shamisen and voice.
Western composers going all the way back to Debussy, who heard Gamelan and said, I can translate this to Western instruments, which had to be going through your head. So now we go to this another fabric of your life. And so we should say you are a professor of music at MIT. You were also the inaugural director, and I want to get it right, of MIT's Center for Arts, Science, and Technology, which is easily acronymed down to CAST. You also run MIT's Sounding Performance Thing. So of all places to come back and tell me if I'm right in this leap, is it, I would think you're thinking, how can I translate this sound into instruments I know and can play on? But you thought, no, I'm going to create. I know you were playing with the West Coast group, but you're going to create. And of all places, unlikely places, that a gamelan orchestra would turn up, it's MIT. And let's put a footnote in here, which you can talk about, is that like 50% of undergrads at MIT who are in the science and engineering sign up for classes in music and theater, which... these are all facts people go, huh? He is talking about the MIT in Boston. So, I mean, draw these connections and why you formed this group, Galactica.
Yeah, well, I actually, just to backtrack a little bit,
yeah,
I will
sure.
say that I didn't immediately think about how I was going to put it in my own music. That actually was the opposite. There's something I really loved about it that I didn't realize I loved about it was that I didn't feel any pressure to put it in my own terms. It was so fascinating to me in its own right. And I was drawn to it because it was a way to do music without thinking, okay, I have to write a better piece and then get it out there and get it performed and make my reputation and try to get famous and try to get commissions and, you know, try to prove that I'm, you know, worthy of doing this. I could just learn this music. Somehow, because it was removed from my culture, it allowed me to leave an incredible amount of subjective and pointless baggage aside. And so really, for the first several years, I was still composing my own music, but gamelan was kind of separate, and I liked it that way. And then it was really only around the late 1980s, when I'm playing the music, studying the music for almost a decade, that I began to have this very strong desire to compose for it and to combine it with Western instruments. And I think I just needed the time to digest it and figure out what it was to me. And it really had to do with this thing where at a certain point I would listen to Balinese pieces I didn't know, whether traditional pieces or new pieces, and I kind of knew what was going to happen in them in the same way that you can listen to, I don't know, you know, an obscure Haydn symphony that you hadn't heard before, and you go, oh, I know where this is going.
Right.
It's going to end up in the dominant, then
right.
it's going to do this, oh, here comes that, you know. Like, I was fluent in the language.
Yeah.
And it was at that point that I started to think, what can I do with this that really makes it my own music? And it was around that time that I moved back east. So,
yeah, 93 is when you formed.
Yeah, yeah.
This. How do you propose that to the people at MIT? Because it's not like you pull out the instrument catalog and order a gamelan.
I mean, propose it in completely stealthy ways. I think, you know, the thing about being at MIT, first of all, the reason I went there was because there was an openness of thought there that I could see even when I interviewed there. Or I kind of thought, and I won't name any places, but there were other places that were interested in me and that I was interested in. And I thought, if I go here to this very august kind of large music school, I'm going to have to change what I do or they're going to fire me.
Right.
And at MIT, I just got this sense that there was this openness to, that there was no reason to track what you did any particular way. You didn't have to follow the model of what it maybe used to mean to train a musician or to teach students. And the students are super smart and they're super creative. They're problem solvers. They're interested in anything that's new and fascinating to them. I started the group and I had no idea who was going to join. The first person to call me was a guy named Richard Stallman, who was and is the head of the Free Software organization, basically one of the early open software designers of what turned into Linux. Mm-hmm. And so he joined right away. It was no problem getting people interested because it didn't matter that it was from Bali or from this tradition or whatever. It was just weird and cool. And it was pattern-based. You know, one of our first members was a postdoc, and I don't even remember what he was a postdoc in. And he joined the group kind of late, so we were learning a big piece, and there was a very long pattern, and he had to learn it. And he said, well, can you just show me, let's give me a diagram of the pattern. It was like 2 pages of just like numbers. And he looked at it for about 30 seconds and went, yeah, okay, got it. That was a kind of unusual experience, but there's just an experimental tradition there that goes a long way back. And also MIT has had experimental art for a long time. They had the Center for Advanced Visual Studies, which was doing artistic research in the 70s, and Otto Pena and Jurgi Kepes. You know, so there was actually this underground stream of art in MIT. The students, the thing with music in general in MIT, that's just been growing and growing, but it's kind of insane now, you know, that there's so many students there wanting to do music that come in there. They're amazing violinists, or they've already composed hours of electronic music, or they're building software. I mean, two of the other first members of my gamelan then went to the Media Lab for graduate work and then started a company called Harmonix Music Systems, which invented Guitar Hero and Rock Band.
Okay, yeah. That did come out of there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I still have all the junk in my basement from my son's playing that. Not to carry the MIT, but you had students playing or other people playing. You're filling out your gamelan orchestra. Then you have to play. So then you got a public. I mean, when gamelan would appear in the East Coast, which it did because you had the world music thing going and all that stuff, but they were specific venues and crowds went. But you were hoping for a more general acceptance of this, obviously, by doing this. So you had to also educate a public up there about what this was.
Yeah, but that, again, I wasn't thinking about it in those terms. I mean, really what I was thinking about was I had gotten so much out of playing in gamelan on the West Coast, right, and in Bali, obviously. And I had moved east because I wanted to, you know, I was ambitious, and I wanted to connect with the New York scene and wanted to get my own music out there. And I thought, okay, well, I've done gamelan for 9 or 10 years, and now I can sort of put it aside. When I moved to MIT in 1990. And then I just really missed it. And I just thought, I need to have gamelan in my life. And then I thought, if I need to have gamelan in my life, there's probably other people that do too. So I'm just going to start this thing. And I mean, MIT didn't really know what it was getting, but it didn't really care. I mean, I was junior faculty. They are used to people asking for hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to set up a lab.
Yeah.
I was, you know, asking for what on their terms seemed a pretty modest amount of money to buy what they thought was a musical instrument. You know, because it basically costs less than a piano, and universities buy pianos, right? So then, you know, it got shipped, and suddenly we had this gamelan, and then they had to do something with it, so they had to find me a place to put it. And
I was thinking, you know, if you're surrounded by science people at MIT, too bad they didn't have like a marketing department there, because I was thinking of the old Got Milk commercials. You can have Got Gamelan.
Got Gamelan. Right.
Last thing here, and I want to move to other parts of your career, but and I'm not going to take credit for this thought because it comes from Steve Mackey, the composer here at Princeton, because he was talking about one of his pieces once. He was talking about how the indigenous...
Yeah, he's talking about his piece, Indigenous
Instruments. Yeah. And you know, this, he's talking about how it fascinated him, but it also fascinated him that we can think of odd sounds and strange sounds to us, and yet to other people, it's vernacular. And I'm just wondering, as you went down the path of gamelan from 81 to 93, was it ever a danger zone to say, we're going to bring this, we're going to concertize it, put it in front of people who don't maybe have any base of reference, yet to the Balinese, this is something quite different. I mean, did it ever...
Oh, yeah, but that's actually been a major source of interest for me, that what you do with that clash of cultures. First of all, I mean, I think we all do it, but to go, well, to the Balinese it means this, or to the Balinese it means that, is, you know, discounting the fact that they're a bunch of individuals. Yeah. So definitely there are Balinese people, Balinese artists, but just Balinese regular folk who think Balinese art should be for the Balinese. But there's also people like our guest composer, Dewa Alit, whose piece is on the program. You know, he grew up in an unelectrified little village in Bali, and basically when he was a teenager, got in contact with my little group, not me personally, but, you know, with the kind of enclave of Americans who were there studying gamelan. And he started hearing our music, and he thought, oh, you know, you could do something with gamelan that really took it out of Bali and made it something else. And he's having the opposite reaction to mine. And he's gone on, he and his brother formed the group Sudamani, which is, you know, now an international touring group that does all new music for gamelan. He still has his own group in Bali, and he invents tuning systems and builds gamelans that are in these kind of wild tunings. And he's been composing for Ensemble Modern in Germany and stuff. And so he's on his own journey that goes the other way. I mean, the way I look at it, I love traditional Balinese music, and I love playing it, and I love helping others learn something about it. And I like presenting that to the public, too. So I don't think that what we're doing in terms of new music, in terms of more experimental things, adding other instruments, just taking it out, I don't see that as supplanting anything. Right. It's more just kind of making some new space for those of us who are rooted one place but kind of want to look someplace else.
Music for gamelan by my guest today, Evan Zaporin. The opening minutes from Kem Kem Bangang, an adaptation of a piece by Balinese composer Nyoman Winda for gamelan and male singers and dancers. Here, a saxophone quartet takes the place of the singers.
I know you need gamelan, but we're going to move to other parts of your career. You are also a composer-performer, and this is a trend making a mighty comeback in the last 30 years, which is really good. Was that always the case with you? I mean, if you look at your music, are you saying the vast majority, high percentage, you're performing that music? I mean, talk about being, because it's really important in your career. It's some composers that sort of sidelined. And
I wouldn't say it's the vast proportion. And in fact, I would love it to be less, you know, but I self-publish. So, you know, my music doesn't get distributed as much as I would like. But I mean, if I have the chance, I'll put myself in a piece. But I'm very happy if I get a commission to write, you know, for a string quartet or for Silk Road Ensemble or for an orchestra or my advisor I've worked with quite a lot or, you know, people out of the blue. I'm happy to compose for other people. When I compose for myself, it's definitely a different thing. I don't know how to answer that in a way that gives you a sense of how I see the balance. Basically, I consider myself a musician. To me, a musician is somebody who can play and can compose, can improvise, you know, that can just be in a musical situation.
Well, I guess I'm asking the mindset because it's interesting. Some of the younger composers, some high profile, I think like a Caroline Shaw, just on Pulitzer Prize, she'll write pieces that she performs.
Yeah.
And they're really not performable, they may be,
right,
by others. And I'm just wondering, because you've been at this longer, the composer performer thing, are there pieces where you're poised to saying, I'm playing this and I'm not sure how to translate what needs to be played to somebody?
Yeah, well, so what's happened with that is that there were a number of pieces that I would make for myself that I never even bothered to really finish the scores for,
right,
because I would fill in the blanks. But then other clarinet players would get in touch with me and they'd want to play it. And so I would figure out ways to do versions that other people could do. And I think this is what a lot of people do. I think somebody like Frederick Jevsky is really similar, right? Like, I mean, you can get him to send you a score of something like People United Will Never Be Defeated or De Profundis. But, I mean, I turned pages for Jevsky when I was younger, when he played that piece. And he wasn't playing what was on the page.
Right, right.
And it's fine. You know, I mean, so it's more, I have my way of doing my pieces, but then I have a way that I can transmit it to somebody else who can do it.
Yeah.
But increasingly, in my own clarinet playing in particular, I'm a lot more interested in giving myself less restrictions. So the biggest project I've been working on, which I've been working on with my collaborator, my wife, Christine Southworth, is a piece for video and electronics and bass clarinet. And basically, that piece is called In My Mind and In My Car, and it's a kind of ongoing, it's like an evening-length piece. But the electronics are set and the video is set, and then I just do what I want.
Okay.
And so that connects back to my interest in open forms. I love figuring out improvisational situations that work.
Yeah, I want to get to you as an improviser here too, but just along those lines, because whatever you were doing, whatever caught somebody's ear, in 87 you appeared at the Bang on the Can Marathon.
Yep.
92 you formed Bang on the Can All-Stars, which just takes all everything that was happening in New York City and sends it out globally so people can hear it and it goes on recordings, blah, blah, blah. 25 years, kind of, you spent with Bang on the Can.
Mm-hmm.
As you look back on that, and as you teach young composers now, see what younger generation of people are doing as creative, can you quantify what Bang on the Can has meant? I know it's still going, but I'm just saying, you know, because you and David,
I mean,
and Michael and Julia are all, you know.
What, for me, Bang on the Can was an amazing common ground.
Right.
With the composers that you mentioned and with the players in the group, some of whom I still work with quite closely. Just a way to kind of be with musicians who shared our concerns and kind of fight the fight that we felt needed to be fought at that time.
Right.
I mean, I think that Bang on the Can was part of a change that was happening in contemporary music, where when we started doing it, there was a lot of alienation between what was considered uptown music and what was considered downtown music. And we were interested in both, and we were interested in finding ways to put the music that we loved, whether it was rock and roll or jazz or, in my case, non-Western music, into the mix and being full musicians, kind of making our music reflect completely who we were and not just leaving three quarters of the stuff we liked at the door when we went into the rehearsal or when we started composing, you know, taking the quotation marks off when we did use it. So now that seems really like everybody's doing that.
Yeah.
You know, but at the time, that was an argument that had to be made, you know. And so for me now, I look around and I see incredible young composers who seem very free and very comfortable, you know, adding electric guitar to their music or making their music be a kind of performance art or bringing in non-Western instruments or just doing all sorts of stuff that for us was a battle that we had to justify and that we felt, you know, within that realm we really had to fight to make a place for. The fact that that's changed is fantastic. I don't know, you know, how much that group had to, you know, we may have been a little ahead of the curve in that way. And certainly I think we probably helped a lot of young musicians feel they could be free.
Groups like Eighth Blackbird, Ice, Larmel Sound, they're all going to fully pay their indebtedness to ensembles and groups like Bang on the Can, organizations like that. This is a weird question, but if you had, you know, 19-year-old young composer come to you at MIT, and you mentioned Bang in a Can, and they said, as only some kids that age can, what's that?
Hmm.
I mean, is that okay? I mean, do you feel that what Bang in a Can did, that's what I'm saying, can be quantified, or is it okay that just what you laid out, this composer can pick up, even if they're
well,
not
sure
where
it came from? Well, you have to understand, it took me by surprise that students knew what it was.
Well, that's good.
So, No, I don't. Yeah, that's perfectly fine because that's the way it works. Everybody has to kind of reinvent the wheel or discover sex for themselves, you know, whatever it is. I mean, not to be too self-centered about it, but, you know, I got something incredibly important out of that time with that group, both in terms of what I learned from the other musicians. I mean, this again backtracks a bit, but I had no idea how to structure a career as a performer or composer. And I had no idea what it really meant to be a performer until I started working with people like Steve Schick and Maya Beiser. You know, just what went into committing yourself to that discipline. So, you know, that was what it was all about for me. But in the long run, I always felt that it was more about moving the culture. I think David Lang would say the same thing. And so it doesn't really matter if the kids today know who the group is. I still hope that my music has some relevance. And I feel like, you know, when you've been around on the scene a long time, everybody goes, and I remember thinking this when I met, you know, when I was 25 and I met composers in their late 50s or early 60s, like, you're set and basically you're done, you know. Like, I'm not really expecting anything to be too different for you in the future. But now that I'm on the other side, I still feel the same way I felt when I was 25. I still feel like music is a process of discovery. I don't really want my music to stay in the same place. I just want to continue.
Well, yeah, I would congratulate, if that's the right word. I mean, your music, there's different sound worlds there. There's lots of different things going on. There's certainly not adherence to any kind of traditional forms, like I said, are predictable. So at times, I mean, there's over your career, there's times when, you know, you're confident, you know, is the audience getting it all? But there's that kind of fearlessness, which is sort of in that group, bang of the can group, where it really doesn't matter. I mean, because you've written pieces that are politically concurrent with things happening and all the rest of that. But there's something to applaud about that kind of just saying, here it is, you know.
Well, thanks. I mean, I think that's a very generous way to read it. I mean, I think we were just trying to do what, in my case, maybe I benefited from, no, I don't know. Actually, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little tongue-tied about it. I was just writing the music that I felt I had to write.
Yeah.
And it's not like I could have switched to a different style if I wanted to, you know. Once you make it and you've done it, you just have to put it out there. And there were all sorts of things. I mean, the scariest one for me actually wasn't even a composition. It was the Brian Eno Music for Airports project, yeah. Which we took on, you know, in the mid-90s. And I really remember it was a fairly big deal premiere at Alice Tully, certainly for us at that time. And the place was packed and it had gotten a lot of publicity. And we did this piece. We actually, for the premiere, we got a big group together. We expanded it out. We basically had like a small orchestra on stage and I was conducting it. So I had my back to the audience. And I remember in the middle of it going, when I'm done and I turn around, how many people are going to be left in the audience?
Yeah.
And what are they going to do? Like, I really had no idea what kind of reaction we were going to get. You know, that's a very interesting space to be in because you can't see the audience. But that's the thrill of it, so.
Okay. Come on. Come here, quick. Hold on, our muscle. Dum-dum-bi. What does mean dum-dum-bi? Dum-dum-bi.
Okay.
From my guest Evan Zaporin's theater piece called Shadow Bang, combining aspects of Balinese traditional shadow puppetry, here's the movement Angkat, where a demon's army goes out seeking suitable enemies to conquer. The Bang on a Can All-Stars perform with vocals by E. Wayan Ouija. My guest performs on the soprano sax, clarinet, and bass clarinet. Thank you.
kind of always had this, again, over your career, whether you're doing jazz, but, you know, some composers, they're not performers, so that wouldn't play into it. Some who are performers, this is an area where, you know, they tread lightly, but that's improvising, and you've sort of come cyclically back to it, and it's this really incredible trio you've got going right now, which is you and Iva Bitova, the Czech violinist and vocalist, who's amazing. Jan Riley, who is a guitarist, but also son of the legendary Terry Riley. So what does this feel? I mean, this is true improvisation, because those other two artists, that's their sort of bread and butter.
It's actually, well, I mean, I was playing jazz since I was 10 or 11 years old, right? And I actually made a very bad career. You know, I made money, very bad money, in my 20s playing jazz. So one of the things that happened was I was in Africa in the 80s, and I made these recordings with these fantastic South African guitarists for South African Broadcasting of mainstream jazz with these amazing guitarists, right? Okay. And I never got a copy of that recording. Then it turned up on Archival African Music website like a few years ago. At first, which was a completely strange kind of Zelig-like experience. Like, what am I doing on an Archival African Music website? And then I listened to it. And
you're the one that has a gamelan orchestra at MIT. Just, right, by okay, the way, okay, it's okay. A little footnote.
Well, so, you know, it sounded a lot better than I remembered it sounding. Yeah. I had just gradually been rediscovering. A lot of it was through working with Eva and other projects, because we had done some things with her with Bang in a Can. You know, I had developed a musical relationship with her and just wanting to be free in that way again. And I had always admired groups like the Art Ensemble of Chicago, Robo Saxophone Quartet, or groups where it wasn't just about free improvisation, but it also wasn't head-based, play the tune, you improvise, come back to the head thing, that there was this fluidity between composition and improvisation that you could only do if you really had an intuitive connection with the particular musicians, right? I met Gian through his dad, through Terry Riley, who, because the gamelan commissioned a piece from Terry, and Terry came up and said, well, can I bring Gian up too? And during that concert, the three of us improvised together. So Terry and me and Gian, and, you know, Terry is fantastic, and I've improvised with him many times, and that's always great. But Gian was a discovery to me. I felt that connection that I also felt with Eva. Yeah. It's something you can't just make happen and you can't predict. We can just walk on a stage together and start. You know, we don't even really have to make a set list. But what if we rehearse and actually make a set list? So we developed pieces that do that thing that those groups I mentioned did so well, where at some point there's composed material. And at some point, maybe the guitar is playing a line that's written out, or Eva's singing a tune, but there's always complete freedom for anybody to go anywhere with it at any time, you know? So it was just what I needed at that point. We started that group right around the time I left Bang in a Can. I just needed to liberate my playing, and with their help, I moved the needle a little bit in that regard.
Well, I hope what people have been able to hear is I've sort of framed this as different fabrics. You've got all these things going on which keep you very creative, and I think it's great. It seems very healthy. I don't know. That's very great. As we're surrounded by this gamelan orchestra.
Sure. I mean, look, it goes back to what I was saying about people needing gamelan in their lives. Like, I was really moved by what I was getting from working in that style and working with my West Coast group, Sekar Jaya, which is Michael Tenzer's group, which now, you know, has become like an institution in the Bay Area. You know, they had a gamelan Sekar Jaya day in Berkeley a couple of years ago. And I really wanted to create that kind of environment in any musical situation. So, I mean, with Bang in a Can, it was to create, with those kind of professional musicians, to create a situation where we could work in that way. But with the gamelan, I wanted a community group. And that's what I've got. And when your listeners hear the recording, I mean, there are people in this group who are professional musicians. There are people in this group who are working in the music industry as software designers. There are people in this group who just have a great interest in Bali, or a couple people from Indonesia. And then there are people who literally do not play any other kind of music at all. Our gong player walked by a rehearsal in 1995. We were rehearsing outside and said, "What are you guys doing?" And a member of the group said, "Well, why don't you sit down and play?" He's not a musician. He's never played an instrument in his life. Now he's been in the group for 20 years. And now he also, I mean, he has a day gig. But he, you know, he started singing and he started getting interested in klezmer music. And, you know, he spends his free time doing that. So, like, it just opened up a whole door for him to kind of be a more musical person. I agree that that's healthy.
Maybe you really made it in Boston when someone invites Galactica to play on a float on one of those many sports championship parades that you guys have every year in Boston.
We've played with the Boston Pops.
There you go.
So,
you go. Well, keep doing what you're doing. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been doing with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to, what's the first name that pops in if I ask that question? If you think about it, you get flooded. But when I asked that, what was the first name?
Stravinsky.
It would be Stravinsky?
Yeah. And Bartok. I mean, Stravinsky just because, like everybody, it was the explosion of the Rite of Spring that, you know, for him and then for so many of us afterwards, we heard it. But Bartok, I really want to know more about what was really going on inside of him when he started going to the villages and recording that music and taking it seriously in a way that other composers hadn't.
Bartok was the genesis of the Nonesuch Explorer series.
Yeah, right. He was the Nonesuch Explorer.
He was. Final question is non-musical. Everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're extremely busy with many things. When you have to do something non-musical, take yourself away, respite, relaxation, enjoyment, pleasure. What do you do that can pull yourself when you need to?
Scuba dive.
Yeah. Wow, I wasn't expecting that.
Well, I wasn't either. It was actually my wife got me into it. Okay. But there's something really magical. It connects with an interest in, for me, it's just as much about the internal state, the breathing and the stillness and the meditation part of it, and just immersing yourself in this situation that you can't really control. And so you have to kind of find a calmness.
Well, I know they have these inner city places where you can learn to, where do you go to, I mean, you're not going
well,
to
I learned
Boston.
In Bali.
You're in Bali, you're not going to Boston Bay.
No. I learned in Bali, and now we've been finding, we just got back from Cuba, and scuba dived in the Bay of Pigs. It's a little weird.
Evan Zaporin, thanks for taking some time.
Oh, thanks, David.
Composer Evan Zaporin. You can find out more about him at his website, simply Zaporin, Zaporyn.com. And you can find out what's up with his gamelan ensemble at their website, Galaktika, GalakTika.org. I'll post the entire music from the Institute for Advanced Study broadcast from last Friday featuring my guests, Gamelan Ensemble, with special guest Sumi Koneko, directly under the link for this cadenza on our webcast page at our website. I'll leave you with a mashing up of two worlds that my guest inhabits, the final movement from his work titled Tire Fire, available on the New World Records label, this for electric guitars, keyboard, electric bass, and gamelan, here the Gamelan Galaktika, music by my guest today, Evan Zaporin. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg. This has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you.